Good evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Impoga. And this evening we'll talk about the struggle for peaceful transitions in Africa. And with us tonight, I'll be joined momentarily by my colleague, Abdushakur Aboud of VOA Swahili Service. He'll be joining us momentarily. And joining us from Nigeria is Segun Arebikem. He is the former editor-in-chief of the News Agency of Nigeria. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening.
How is Lagos?
Lagos is fine.
Good to hear that. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Yes. We also have Dr. Christopher Kayumba of the School of Journalism at the National University of Rwanda. He joins us by phone from the capital, Kigali. Good evening, Dr. Kayumba.
Good evening, Douglas.
How are you? Is Kigali fine?
Kigali is very fine. I think it's drizzle.
Good to hear that. Drizzle, they say, is a sign of good things to happen.
Yes, good luck, we say in Africa.
Yes, thanks very much. Well, as I said, our topic tonight is going to be the struggle for peaceful transitions in Africa, political transitions ranging from elections to peace agreements after civil war have often served as triggers of violence. A significant body of research shows that in Africa, elections, a hallmark of democracy and in many cases the culmination of peace agreement, have been shown to be violent about 25% of the time. Now, talking of transitions, Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, begins 2015 at the brink of both a historically important election and a breakdown of state authority that is, according to some, simultaneously cause and effect of the Islamic Boko Haram rebellion. Let's start in Lagos with my friend Segun. First of all, bring us up to date about the election program. We know that it was postponed to March 28th. Is everybody excited about that? Is everybody doing what it takes to have a peaceful and free and fair election?
Well, let me give you a little bit of background. There are two main political parties, the PDP, that is the governing party, and you have the main opposition group called the APC, or Progressive Congress. The PDP wanted a postponement because the main reason they argued was that the electoral body, INEC, wasn't ready. People had challenges of collecting their permanent voters' cards. So they saw that as a big hindrance to free and fair election and therefore wanted a postponement. The other group said, no, the election should go on. But INEC, after consultation with the parties and the political groups, and then maybe the civil society groups, initially said they were ready and that the election could go on. But barely a week after that, the security people came in. The INEC chairman told the nation that he had been informed by the heads of the various security services in the country that they could not guarantee a peaceful election because they would be busy handling challenges against the fight against Boko Haram, and therefore requested that the election be postponed by some weeks.
Yes.
Which, of course, I never bought into, and therefore postponed the election by 6 weeks. That is why we moved the election from 14 February, for instance, to 28th of March, and the second, the one with by the governors, the governorship, and the National Assembly elections, too, will come on 2 weeks after that.
I see. Well, that points well taken. You mentioned two issues there. The issue of the INEC not having been ready, or people alleging they were not ready, and the more crucial issue of the Boko Haram insurgency. Boko Haram, as we all know, and our listeners may know, has been there for years. How sure are people, ordinary man in Lagos, in Abuja, in Kano, how sure are they that the government will be able to contain the insurgency within the next 6 weeks, now 5 weeks or so?
In fact, that is the argument of the opposition group, that we've had this Boko Haram insurgency for 5 years. We are in the sixth year of the insurgency. If the government couldn't contain them in 5 years, how could he do that in 6 weeks? the INEC people appear to me to be to have their hands tied, because that was what the implication, what I got from the statement or the press conference addressed by the chairman of INEC, that if you don't have the security people who are going to help you to curb any electoral violence, then you can't possibly organize a free and fair election. In fact, the point is, even the security people even pointed out that, look, you need to move electoral materials from wherever it is kept for safekeeping to the various centers. Who is going to do that? They will do that. And if they say they are not ready, then that you have a problem on your hand. So that is the key thing the opposition people are saying. But for now, it seems to me the opposition to have accepted, let's have the election in the interest of the country. Let's move the election forward and see. But I'm sure they have also got the president to give an undertaking. Yesterday, the president was on national radio and television, what they call media chat, where he was asked some questions, and he did made a commitment that the elections will hold on March 28th.
I see. Dr. Kayumba, Christopher, what do you make of that scenario in Nigeria? I thought elections were like an exam where there's a set time, everybody knows the set time, and it's supposed to take place, regardless whether it has rained or there's sunshine.
Exactly, Douglas. I think there are probably two issues there that, as far as I can see. One, I think the postponement of the elections is indictment on the government, because the government, as you say, is giving two issues. One is security, then the other one is the unreadiness of the Electoral Commission. But the issue of security, if you look at the GDP of Nigeria, if you look at the wealth of Nigeria, now it has overtaken South Africa, it is the biggest economy on the continent. It has one of the biggest militaries on the continent. How can they really fail to manage the problem of Boko Haram? Mm-hmm. I don't understand that one. So that one is an indictment on the government. The other one is a related issue that I can see. It is a management and an organization issue. You know, human civilization has evolved, and one of the elements that make us better human beings today, it is because we can organize. Now, and as you say, elections are not accidents. Nigeria has known that it will hold elections. It is difficult to understand how the Electoral Commission of Nigeria can fail to distribute voter cards in time when it has known all these years that it will be holding elections. So that is an organization and management problem, and it tells us a lot about the nature of the state on the continent.
I see. Let me go back to Segun. Following up from your reporting, from what you hear over there, is it true to suggest that if the army doesn't give go ahead on March 28th, maybe there could be another postponement? Because if they say they are not ready or they can't control all the areas, then of course the INEC can't go ahead. Is that the feeling among the people, or I don't have it correct?
Nobody is thinking of that. In fact, I do also not think that in the interest of the army, for their own image, they are not likely to come out to call for a second postponement. I don't think that will happen. But what is more important is that the president has committed himself to the March 28th date, and I do not see anything happening to change that.
I see. Well, let's talk now about institutions. And because we're talking about Nigeria now, is of course the most populous country, powerful, wealthy. I mean, it means a lot to Africa. But the problem is the rampant across the continent. If you move towards the east there, there are rumors that, for instance, in Uganda, there's never been peaceful change, peaceful transfer of power since 1961. Which was an interim administration. In several other areas, the governments find it difficult to transition peacefully to another. So, basically, let me begin with Christopher in Kigali. What's the problem? Why do people find it difficult to pass on power to the next team or generation?
I think the struggle, the difficulty of transferring power from either one party to the next or from one individual to the other has probably four elements to it. One is, I think, the role of political violence in gaining political power. And this, I think, tells us or speaks to our political culture. The political culture, I think, on the continent has been for many years such that individuals, organizations, rebel groups, you are talking about Uganda, NRM, you are talking about in DRC, in Kabila, you are talking about Rwanda, you are talking about Burundi. There has been the role of the gun in gaining political power. Second, it is inorganic political systems. Inorganic political systems in a way that the political systems that we have in much of Africa are political systems adopted after colonial rule. And these political systems require rule of law, following rule of law. But as you, and this of course speaks to our political history. Before colonialism, we had the rule where monarchical rule, where the king could never give up power until they die. So we transition from a culture where rule is forever, a king rules for forever. Then we go to rule of law that requires respecting the rules. I don't think we have the culture that respects rule of law. The third point, it is the nature of the presidencies on the continent. I think presidencies on the continent are too powerful. The power that presidents hold is too powerful, such that it undermines other institutions like the legislature, like the judiciary, and you find, therefore, that the regime is directly connected to the institution that brought that government in power, and that is the military. Mm-hmm. That is why you find a man like President Museveni calling a national army, that this is my army. So the president is so powerful, it is connected to the military, and therefore that makes consent, rule of law, where power belongs to the people, extremely weak. The last point is the nature of our society. If you look at most countries on the continent, you will find that most of our people are less educated, and therefore their involvement in the issues of the state, in issues of democracy, and holding government to account is very limited. Mm-hmm. If you look at civil society and the political opposition, they are also, in most cases, very weak. And that also is connected to the nature of our economy, because in most of Africa, you find that even some members of the opposition beg the president. Sometimes we see where a president is handing over money. Sometimes they even hand over districts. I have seen this in Uganda. Mm. But I think, therefore, that having a peaceful transition, when you have the environment that does not facilitate that, is extremely difficult, because the stability, the development of the country is seen in the good health of one man, and that is the president.
I see. Shegun, let's pick up on some of the points raised by Christopher there. Let's talk about, first of all, the nature of the gun, because I'm still concerned about the areas controlled by Boko Haram, the northeast. If the army can't contain them, how feasible is it that you can have an election in an area that where people are running up and down and some of them are displaced? What does the INEC say to that effect? How will they distribute the ballot papers and cards and count the votes in such a situation?
It's one of the reasons the INEC argues for wanting to shift the election. Because they said if the military, who are supposed to assist the police in maintaining law and order and to ensure a peaceful election, say they cannot provide security, they didn't think the police could do it adequately. So they thought the best thing to do was to shift it. But the truth of the matter is that in spite of the Boko Haram insurgency, there are only about 16 local governments across three states of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe that are really affected by insurgency. So if you were to hold elections, you can say with all certainty that there is no way you could hold elections in those 16 local governments. And Nigeria has 774 local governments. So if you have 16 compared with the large number of 774, then you're looking at a small number, really. But since INEC has decided that the election will be shifted, so be it. So I think they are started without responsibility. And if they agree with the security chiefs that they can't maintain law and order during the election, then I think that's why Nigerians have accepted that. But I'm hopeful that the 28th March date will not be changed.
I see. Well, gentlemen, stick to your thoughts. Let's take a short break. We'll be back to continue our discussion of the struggle for peaceful transitions in Africa.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
Welcome back. In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to Reporters Roundtable, and we're coming to you live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. Our topic tonight is the struggle for peaceful transition in Africa. Our panelists are Segun Arebike, the former editor-in-chief of the News Agency of Nigeria, and Dr. Christopher Kayumba of the School of Journalism at the National University of Rwanda. And I'm your host, Douglas Simpoga, here in Studio 9. Now, Christopher, there are those who say that all these issues we have on the continent as regards to peaceful transitions or lack thereof is because there's no culture of respecting the constitutions in those countries. Most African countries have, by the way, as a fact, have very wonderful, good constitutions on paper. But they struggle to... nobody respects them. You can sit across there are people who have been powerful. Mugabe has been powerful since he became Prime Minister in 1980 in Zimbabwe. Kabila is trying to change it there. We mentioned Burundi, the same problem. Uganda, they have tinkled with the constitution many times. Is the lack of respect for the constitution a key factor in this lack of peaceful transitions?
Actually, I would say that it is the general disrespect for the rule of law, generally.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it were only lack of respecting the constitution, where you have rule of law, presupposing checks and balances between institutions. That means if the chief executive or the president does not respect the constitution and wants it changed such that they can have they can stay in power as long as they want, on his own he cannot do it. He has to go to parliament. But as I said, parliament is also extremely weak. You have seen what happened in Uganda, changing the two terms to deleting the term limit was very easy for President Museveni handing over money to imagine a member of parliament taking $5 million to accept to change a principle that they voted thinking that it is good for their country. Now, when you read the media, they are also interested in changing age limit for the president from 75. Mm-hmm. Maybe they delete that one as well. If it is only disrespect for the constitution by one organ, I would say it, but I think it is the general disrespect for the rule of law, and also rule of law presupposing also the independence of the judiciary. Most judiciaries on the continent are weak. They follow orders from the executive. That is why in many countries, the judicial system is respected. So it is the general disrespect for rule of law.
I see. Shegun, you want
and
to...
And, of course, that speaks to the political culture.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, as you know, that political culture has to evolve over time because there are also examples. Let us not generalize here. There are some examples. We are talking about Nigeria. President Olusegun Obasanjo wanted the elite in family. He didn't get his way in Zambia. Former President Chiruba wanted to do the same. He failed. So there are some cases where it is failing, and maybe these ones can be cases that can help other countries to make sure that rule of law is respected.
Shegun, you agree with Christopher there?
Yes, I agree with him. But I also want to add that he mentioned earlier that he talked about the power of the president in Africa. And I think that is one of the biggest challenges we have. People, you have a lot of heads of office. You have to dispense favors here and there. And because of that, even the losers, before you know it, try to kowtow to him. Move from one party to the ruling party. It's always the case all the time. So it's always difficult when you have such situation. If you are political leaders who don't believe in any ideology, but ideology of their pocket or stomach, so to say, then you shouldn't expect the incumbent god who then becomes like a king god and doesn't want to leave power, even when it is clear that it's losing power. We've had examples in the past where governments that are losing elections suddenly stop the counting of the votes or they stop the process. And that is something against the constitution of the land. You will expect that when such situations happen, you have people who stand up to say, no, you can't do this. But rather than do that, before you know it, they rather turn to support the person, and he continues in office.
I see. Christopher, there are those who argue that it's a sort of a catch-22 situation. For the rule of law to be respected, there ought to be functioning and capable institutions. You talk about the judiciary. You talk about an impartial police. You talk about civil society that's grounded and that kind of thing. But most of these leaders across the countries, these countries, make sure that those institutions don't function. Therefore, all the power is vested into those chief executives. Isn't that a problem?
I would say yes and no. First of all, you have to understand the nature of power. The nature of power is such that whoever holds it is interested in making sure that they not only retain it, but they expand it. So, partly I agree, but also the problem of having peaceful transition in Africa is also a problem that is societal. It has something to do with our society as well. Because if, for example, I was head of state, and probably I want to stay longer in power, I have to ask society, the people, most of these constitutions we have been talking about, including the one of Uganda, say power belongs to the people. So they take these words to the people, and the people say, yes. So what does that tell us about our people? Either they want it, or they are manipulated, and if they are manipulated, what does it tell us that they are able to be manipulated? So wow. I think the problem is a more societal challenge than an individual problem.
Shegun, I take his point there, but then in some African countries, the will of the people is never adhered to because some elections are predetermined. Dr. Kayumba, who I'm speaking from, your president got almost 90% of the vote. I mean, some elections are predetermined. So the people, on paper, yes, the people count, but in some countries, it's actually the election is predetermined. Shegun, what do you think?
That is, you are very correct. That is because of the point you made about lack of institutions. If you have institutions that are independent, that are supposed to be impartial, who know that their loyalty, first and foremost, is to their nation, not to the political leadership. Because leadership comes and goes. But the institutions remain. The police, the army, the judiciary, and civil society. But the point is, when you have all these institutions, when they are bought over, so to say, by the political authority, then you give the, it gives the political authority the free way to do whatever you like.
Mm-hmm.
And so they determine what results of the elections will be if ever before the votes are taken. And that is part of the problem. And I'm sorry to say, you also have a followership that doesn't really care much about what happens in the country.
Mm-hmm.
That, oh, what can we do? It's like the people don't even realize what power they have.
That's true.
I think it's someone who said, people have no need to fear their government, but rather the government ought to fear their people. But in the case of Africa, the opposite is the case.
Mm-hmm.
It's the people who are afraid of their government.
I see, Christopher. I think Segun's point is many Africans in most countries are resigned to the fate of whoever is going to rule. They don't care whether he has to get out. What do you say briefly? We're running out of time in about a minute or so.
No, I think that in most states on the continent, there is a disconnect between the general public and the elite in power. And I think this also speaks to the issue of the power of the citizen. For me, I think a citizen that is valued is that citizen that is able, for example, to pay taxes and hold government to account. There is no, most governments on the continent depend on aid. So most of them ignore the citizens because they don't depend on them. Almost 70% of the citizens in most African countries don't pay taxes. So, and most governments in Africa are what we call rentier states. Rentier states depend on money from elsewhere, from donors. So if you, and that's why most governments in Africa, they depend on the goodwill of Western governments. That's why, for example, you hear Western leaders telling Kabila not to seek a third term, or President Bureau of Burundi not to seek a third term. Why? Because they have they think that he will listen. Because he accounts to them less than he accounts to the citizens of Burundi. So I generally agree that the citizens on the continent are less involved in the affairs of the state.
Yes, because they say the paper chooses the music. So they account where they get the money from. And again, those who say they don't see cause in paying taxes because their money is stolen because of the rampant corruption on across the continent.
Yeah, of course, corruption also plays a very big role. We were talking about the example of Uganda, you know. In the last election, if you read what the media is talking about,
yeah,
there was less violence because this time around a lot of money was used to buy the vote.
Yes.
And we were talking about members of parliament given 5 million to delete presidential term limits.
That's right. Well, gentlemen,
can you imagine members of parliament elected to speak on behalf of the public, to vote, to make good laws, taking a bribe to remove a clause that was voted for by the public?
Taking a bribe, which is now an offense. Well, gentlemen, we're out of time. That wraps up this edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'd like to thank our panel. Thank you, Segun Arabike, former editor-in-chief of the News Agency of Nigeria. And thank you, Dr. Christopher Kayumba of the School of Journalism at the National University of Rwanda. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. And thanks very much for joining us tonight. And until next week, I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington, wishing you all the best.
Sur VOA Afrique.